The godfather of smart beta, Rob Arnott, explains investing fundamentals on this episode of Unlock Your Wealth Today, your life fully invested. Welcome to Unlock Your Wealth Today, your life fully invested. I'm your purveyor of prosperity and host, Heather Wagenhals. And on this episode, I'm making success simple with Research Affiliates founder and chairman, Rob Arnott. I'm really thrilled to have him on this show because I had the opportunity to facilitate an incredible panel about finding financial freedom this summer at Freedom Fest. In addition to bringing all of that body of knowledge with him, he is also going to talk about what built Research Affiliates, why he is the godfather of smart beta, and how you can employ this investing strategy for yourself. Welcome to the show, Rob. It's so great to see you after such an exciting summer.
Well, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Now, we had the good fortune of being on stage together at Freedom Fest as I moderated a panel you were on about finding financial freedom. But that wasn't my first experience with you. And at Freedom Fest, I learned about you in 2018, as a matter of fact, when you were on another panel moderated by one of our guest hosts, Jim Woods, and Keith Fitzgerald, also a past guest of the show. Yeah. And I got to listen to how you think about and make your investment selections. And you were introduced as the godfather of smart beta. So can you explain a little bit what that means when people introduce you that way?
Sure. Back in 2004, we introduced an idea called fundamental index. Fundamental index chooses and weights companies differently from most index funds. Most index funds choose the biggest market capitalization companies, the most valuable, and then weight them according to how big their market value is. Now think about that for a second. A stock that has soared, its price will have gone up, its market value will have gone up. So you wind up being tilted towards companies trading at high multiples. Those are often referred to as the growth stocks. Companies that have tremendous momentum behind them, and you're weighting them according to their popularity. So is a growth tilted, momentum chasing, popularity weighted index the best way to earn money? I don't think so. So back in 2003 and 4, we did some research that led to the fundamental index that instead says, what are the 1,000 largest businesses in the country? Based on objective measures of the size of the business. How much do they have in sales? How much do they produce in profits? How much do they pay back to shareholders in dividends? What's their corporate net worth or book value? Different measures, just like your footprint in the sand at the beach has different measures, length, width, depth of the footprint. The footprint a company has in the macro economy has different measures. So we weight companies according to how big they are. And the result is that if a company is a terrific company, much beloved, trading at lofty multiples, well, that simple fact isn't going to help you make money on the stock if the market's already aware of that and has priced it at a large enough premium to front-end load all of the good news that's expected. It'll only make more money for you than the market if it exceeds lofty expectations. So we reweight those back down to their economic footprint. Companies trading at deep discounts, we recognize they're worse companies. Lousy products, lousy management, slow growth, skinny profit margins, whatever. But that's not going to hurt you because the market's already well aware of it and prices them at a discount. So they're only going to hurt you if they underperform bleak expectations. So fundamental index says, yeah, it's a lousy company, but that's in the price. Let's reweight it back up to its economic footprint. Now, what inspired the term smart beta was the fact that this strategy as the market changes its mind about a company and gets more or less enthusiastic, contra trades against the market's most extravagant bets if the growth in confidence in the company isn't accompanied by a growth in the business. And so you're, okay, you wind up rebalancing and creating a rebalancing alpha. The consultants Towers Watson out of London liked the idea enough that they called it smart beta. They looked around for other strategies that break the link between the price of a stock and its weight in the portfolio. And there are lots of such strategies, equal weight, minimum variance strategies, anything that doesn't anchor on capitalization weighting. And so they said, that's smart beta. And the term stuck, was in fact embraced by the whole investment management community and applied to all sorts of ideas, including some that aren't the least bit smart. So I've been called the godfather of smart beta because I came up with fundamental index, and fundamental index inspired the term.
Okay, so what are some of the things that you enumerated briefly, but what are some of the factors? You know, let me give you an example of what I'm looking for as an answer. So when it comes to credit scoring models, they're mm-hmm. weighted differently. There are 85 factors that go into a credit score, but only three of them out of those 85 make a hill of beans worth of difference and move that score. And again, because it's a statistical number, it's based on what's in your profile compared to every other person that has a similar experience as you. It's not ever like, oh, well, if you have a derogatory mark, it's going to take it down 5 points. No, it's a weighting system. Can you explain mm-hmm. how weighting and factors relate to each other? You mentioned equal weight, and you mentioned a couple
sure.
of those.
Sure. Well, with fundamental index, if a company is, let's say, 2% of the U.S. economy by sales, 3% by profits, 1% by book value, 2% by dividends and stock buybacks, you could argue endlessly about whether it's 1%, 2%, or 3% of the macro economy, or you could just take the average. So our scoring is very transparent and very simple. It's the average of those weights. And if you do that, you wind up with a very simple score that simply says this company is about 2% of the economy. We're going to make it about 2% of our portfolio. In that context, a company like Tesla, popular as heck today, barely makes it into the top 100 companies in the US by the size of their business, but ranks in the top five by the market value of the company. And a company like ExxonMobil is in the top five by the size of their business, but doesn't even make the top 10 by their current market value. And of course, Elon Musk famously in the last week has a personal net worth that is larger than the total market value of ExxonMobil. That's pretty wild.
It's a crazy number when you think about personal net worth. So as we look at these different factors, is there a better system over another, or does it depend on your investment objective which weighting system works best for your investment objectives?
You want to look at investment strategies from a vantage point of, would I stay the course if it goes against me? Because any strategy will go against you from time to time. So in thinking about investments, you have to ask the question, will this strategy freak me out so that I bail out at the wrong time? There have been a number of times in my career when I was sitting next to somebody on the plane who said, I just lost half my money in the stock market. I'm going out. I'm never going to invest in stocks again as long as I live. And my advice to them, which is obviously likely to be ignored, is you're thinking about the market and thinking about investing from a perspective of sell low, buy high. Ours is the only major industry in the global macro economy where people hate bargains.
I'm all about the discount shopping. I'm a female.
Well, there is fashion. My wife's definitely a fashionista. And I have seen her turn down an item because it was cheaper than she expected.
but, it's crazy.
Other than high fashion and a few other and maybe exotic cars, there's very few businesses, and none the size of the investing world, where people hate bargains. In the investing world, imagine if Tiffany's put out a banner sign saying post-COVID sales, everything marked up 20%, and people were bashing down the doors to get in. And Cartier across the street, banner sign, post-COVID sale, everything marked down 20%, and people were shunning the store because something's got to be wrong with it. It's important to remember that anything that's newly cheap got there by inflicting pain and losses. It goes against human nature to say, gee, I liked it fine at a higher price. Now I ought to like it better. If I'm not willing to buy now, I probably never will buy a bargain. And reciprocally, anything that's newly expensive got there by providing great joy and great profit. And it goes against human nature to say, maybe I should trim my joy and profit.
And it's a curious place to be because that has nothing to do with the market and all has to do with psychology and how we view things.
So when you're choosing investments, the first question you should ask is, will I have the staying power if it goes against me? Mm-hmm. Will I have the courage to buy more if it goes against me? If not, you ought to just buy an index fund. And if you do, buy a fundamental index instead of a cap-weighted index. Thank you mm-hmm. very much.
Well, for obvious reasons.
Be that as it may, if you just buy the market, whether it's a cap-weighted index or a fundamental index strategy, you have something nice and steady that matches the movements of the broad economy and of the broad market. Well, that's great. If you want to be more active, you should first ask yourself, do I have the right temperament to be an active investor and to profit from it? Most people don't have that temperament. And that's an interesting, simple fact. I've been at financial advisor conferences and been asked the question, how much should a financial advisor add for our clients' wealth in order to justify what we're doing? And my short answer is zero. If you're adding zero, that's a win, because most people left to their own devices will suffer losses. There's a company called Dalbar that studies the performance of mutual funds on a dollar-weighted basis and a time-weighted basis. And if a fund is up 10% a year in the last 10 years, but the average investor got in after it ran up and bailed out after it faltered, then maybe the average investor dollar-weighted didn't earn 10%, but earned 8% or 7%. That's very typical. Losing 2 or 3% per annum due to human nature is very typical. And somebody's on the other side of those trades. You want to examine whether you're going to be the one funding somebody else's success or whether you're going to be able to capture somebody else's losses. And most people fall into the former category. So being self-aware is hugely important in investing.
So being self-aware. So my nephew is this up and coming young investor and he's in college right now and he loves math and he loves engineering. And so he's kind of following in the footsteps of, say, a John Galt or a Howard Roark. And he's starting to dabble in the stock market. And now he's become so passionate about it that he's flipped his position. And it's like he's just kind of doing what he needs to do to get through school. But every day he's just combing, trying to research strategies and all kinds of different performances, different techniques, and trying to learn and absorb the market. And he's gotten spanked a few times because he's...
We all do.
But that's where the learning comes. I'm like, you're paying for college. You're paying for an education. You have to look at it that way.
I refer to investment losses as tuition.
Exactly. Because if it doesn't sting a little bit, it's not going to stick. That's kind of, if it stings, it sticks in my
And if it
book.
doesn't stick, then you got to re-examine yourself, because for a lot of people, losses are a basis for saying, I'm going to take my marbles and go home, rather than saying, what can I learn from this? Learnings are so important. We all make mistakes in life, in relationships, and of course, in investments. And trying to learn from our mistakes, you learn so much more from your mistakes than from your successes, if you're open to it.
Right. And therein lies the key. And that was probably one of the first things that I said. I said, okay, so you have to find some intestinal fortitude because you have to weather the dips and you have to be willing to make decisions that are based soundly on the right information and let the market do what it does, but know that you're in a company for the right reason, not because it's a market favorite, but because you picked it properly. So once we get over this psychological hump, so we're starting to shore up our intestinal fortitude, and then we're also starting to learn from the painful mistakes that we make. What are the things that we need to be carrying forward as we start identifying some of the simple factors just to begin our company evaluations? If we want to do this, where do we go after we put those two pieces of the puzzle in place?
Well, there's a few pieces that I think are important to put in place first. You can't invest money that you've spent. So, if you want to have financial independence, spend less. There's hardly anyone on the planet who couldn't spend 80% of their income instead of 100%. Even the working poor could, in theory, do that, because almost all of us know somebody who makes 20% less than we do and has a lifestyle not dissimilar to our own. Could we handle that lifestyle? Of course we could. So making the conscious choice to not spend and to set aside 20%, or at least to work your way towards that by setting aside whatever raise you get each year until you are saving 20%, that's a great start. Another thing to do is to check your desire to chase past results. If you took 1,000 people and asked them how do they handle their 401k portfolio, their company gives them this report every quarter showing here's your available investments and here's how they've done over the last 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. How many of us look at that list and look to the bottom performers over the last 3, 5, and 10 years and ask, is there any reason this is not a bargain?
I would say zero do that.
Yeah. Well, I think there might be 1 in 100 who does that.
Okay.
none of us likes losses.
Right.
But that's where opportunities arise. And so if you go through the process of choosing what's done well over the last 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, you're psychologically making the assumption that past winners are future winners. Sometimes that's true. Often it's not. And buying something merely because it's gone up, whether it's a stock or a strategy or a mutual fund, can be a mistake, usually is a mistake. Buying it just because it went up is almost always a mistake. You want to know more about it than just did it go up. So one of the things I'm proud of is that back in 2018, we came up with a workable definition of bubbles, of the word bubble. People talk about bubbles almost always in past tense, the tech bubble of 2000, the Japan bubble of 1990, the energy bubble of 1980, and so forth. And we came up with a very simple definition, and that is if you use a simple valuation model, could be discounted cash flow, could be project next 5 years growth and apply a market multiple to where the stock is going to wind up then, and assume that that's a fair value. Any valuation model, you would have to use implausible assumptions to justify today's price. That's part one. Part two is a cross-check on that. The marginal buyer doesn't care about valuation models. So Tesla's a wonderful example. Tesla, I debated Kathy Wood at the Morningstar conference about a month ago, and she said she set a price of target of 3,000. And I said to her, so what's your exit strategy? And she said, if it hits 3,000, I'll sell. And I said, how do you get the 3,000 number? Mm-hmm. Well, to my surprise, she did have a valuation model. She said the company's going to grow 89% a year for the next 5 years. And if I attach a FANG multiple, like the FANG stocks, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, if I attach a FANG multiple to its profits 5 years from now, if it grows 89% a year for the next 5 years, then it's going to be worth $3,000. And I commended her on having a disciplined analytic framework. But I did say 89% growth a year for 5 years is pretty stupendous. I would argue that it's highly implausible. In point of fact, that would mean that Tesla 5 years from now is 25 times as big a business as it is today in just 5 years. Amazon in the last 10 years has had stupendous growth. It's 14 times as big as it was 10 years ago. Just breathtaking growth. Mm-hmm. So tacitly, she's assuming that it will have twice Amazon's growth, 10-year growth, in just 5 years. Twice as much growth in half as much time. I view that as highly implausible. She doesn't. And the markets will tell us which is right. I may be dead wrong. I've been wrong about Tesla along the way. But as long as you're right about most investments most of the time, you can absorb being wrong parts of the time. And the other thing is to ask the question, what did I miss?
Okay, so let's, in the case of Tesla, what did you miss? Because as I look at it, it doesn't make sense to me either. Just simply, there are not that many buyers at that price point for vehicles. But there's something for everyone on Amazon.
Right. The auto industry creates upwards of 100 million cars a year. Tesla produced 0.5% of that total production last year, 0.5%, and yet it was worth almost 50% of the total value of the auto industry. So viewed as an auto company, and that's one pushback that any Muskophile would push back on. They'd say he's an ideas source. There's battery storage, there's solar, there's the car company, there's the rockets to Mars, et cetera, et cetera. And that's all very well and good. But the question is a buyer of that company's stock, do you get the rockets to Mars? No, that's a different company. Do you get the solar power, the battery power? No, those are different companies. So how much growth do you get in this company? And is the growth assumption implausible if it's set high enough to justify the current price? One takeaway is the impact of sentiment. When I wrote about bubbles in 2018, one point I made very aggressively is that bubbles can go much further and last much longer than any skeptic can possibly imagine. The most extreme example I've ever encountered was the Zimbabwe stock market during their hyperinflation. As you came into the summer of 2008, and hyperinflation was already well underway, they had tens of percentage points of inflation per month already, long before they got to tens of percentage points per day. But in any event, if you came into that market and you looked at it, you'd say, I don't want to own any of these stocks. In fact, I'm going to short sell the market. But I don't know that much about Zimbabwe, so I'm only going to make a 2% bet. 2% of my net worth, I'm going to short the Zimbabwe stock market. Mm-hmm. 6 weeks later, the currency had fallen tenfold. The stock market had risen in Zimbabwe dollar terms 500-fold, meaning in U.S. dollar terms, it was up 50-fold, meaning that your 2% short position just bankrupted you.
Wow.
Now, 8 weeks after that, the currency had fallen another 100-fold, and the stock market basically went to zero and stopped trading. So you were right, but you were wiped out by a bubble.
Right.
So you have to be incredibly careful about bubbles. Sentiment can take them to really extravagant heights.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean you have to own them.
Right. Because I don't sleep any better at night, even though I am a Zimbabwean trillionaire.
Mm-hmm. Most of us are. Most of us have that $500 trillion note somewhere.
I know. I keep it locked up because I think that the sentimental value would cause it to be stolen more than its actual physical paper worth.
Actually, Zimbabwe has made a cottage industry of continuing to print those bills, and they now sell for about $100 each, which is quite funny. But
excellent because, lemons to lemonade.
Yeah, because when they stopped using the currency back at the end of 08, it was worth about $3. And 500 trillion Zimbabwe dollars was worth $3 US. But now it's worth $100. Cool.
Yeah, you know, you just never know when you're looking for these good deals what you can find. So here's my next question. So how can we show, do you have an example off the top of your head of where a bubble played out in favor of this fundamental index? Because, you know, they kind of...
Oh, sure. Countless examples. In fact, I'll use a counterexample to illustrate the point. In the year 2000, Amazon was already fading from its 1999 highs. Those of your viewers who are old enough will remember the famous report entitled Amazon.bomb. It rolled over and was down by almost half from its 1999 highs, and then lost another 80 or 90% in the 2 years after the tech bubble. If you used our definition, you would have said, even after faltering, Amazon would have to achieve implausible growth in order to justify today's price. Well, roll the clock forward 10 years, and Amazon had a negative return for the decade of the aughts. So you looked like you were absolutely right. Roll it forward another 10 years, the growth finally caught up with the valuation in the year 2000 and exceeded it by a wide margin. So bubbles merely mean implausible. They don't mean impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And for every Amazon or Apple that you could identify in the year 2000, there are dozens of companies that have negative returns since the year 2000. Cisco, briefly number one market capitalization company in the world, briefly priced at almost 200 times earnings. And subsequent to the year 2000, they've grown handily. Their sales are up 12% a year for 21 years. Profits are up 13% a year for 21 years. And the share price is down from the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Down. So even if you had projected 13% growth for 20 plus years, that wouldn't have been enough to justify the year 2000 peak price. It was a bubble. Now, that doesn't mean that it couldn't have achieved the growth that would justify that price. It just meant that it was highly improbable. And so the fact that there were scores of tech companies that did not live up to the hype today, looking forward over the next 10 years, is Tesla going to live up to the hype?
Mm-hmm.
I doubt it. Is Amazon going to live up to the coming decade hype? I doubt it. In fact, if you go back historically and look at the 10 most valuable companies in the world, decade by decade, you find that on average, 8 of them fall clear off the list over the next 10 years, and 8 or 9 of them underperform the world market. Those are your largest holdings if you own a cap-weighted index fund. And so if your 10 largest holdings, 9 out of 10 underperform, 8 out of 10 underperform enough to fall clear off the list, what does that tell us about today's list? Today's list is more tech concentrated, or more concentrated in a single industry, than ever before in history. Of the what we call the FANMAG stocks, that's the FANG stocks plus Apple and Microsoft. And then in China, you have the BAT stocks, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. Those comprise most of the 10 largest market cap companies in the world. If you take those companies and you assume that past patterns continue, they compete against one another, so they're not all going to be winners. If 8 out of those 10 fall clear off the list, do you want to start guessing which ones are going to be the survivors? I don't want to play that game. I want to de-emphasize them all and emphasize what's cheap. And today there's a lot of relatively cheap stuff out there, but it's not where people have poured their money. The spread between growth and value last summer was the widest in history. Today it's the second widest in history. It's not as wide as last summer, but it's still a wider spread between growth and value stocks than it was at the peak of the tech bubble. That's pretty remarkable.
So that brings me to my next question. And if, you know, every 10 years we've got this riff here with these cap-focused companies, do we want to have a place in our portfolio for those types of things? If we're looking to build wealth, you know, you've got all these competing strategies. And I remember Mark Victor Hansen, who's been a past guest of this show, like 20 years ago when I saw him speak, he says, when it comes to getting rich, do it both ways. Take the slow boat and the fast boat. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts really are based on the comfort factor, the can you stay the course factor. Fundamental index has a value bias. It's going to emphasize value stocks and de-emphasize growth stocks. When value is struggling, as it was over the last 4 or 5 years, we won't match the market, but we will beat the value indexes. So do you want a portfolio that's all value tilted? Maybe not. I'm fine with it, but many people won't be. So perhaps you partition your portfolio into, here's a segment of my portfolio that's going to look for growth opportunities, look for disruptors, look for investments that are going to change the future. And here's a portion that's going to look for bargains. This can fit very neatly into that second category. And so I'm a big believer in diversification. Right now, just as an example, U.S. bonds are more attractive than European or Japanese bonds because they actually have a positive yield.
Right.
So maybe I'd want to have a little bit in U.S. bonds. I don't know. The yield is terrible, but it's not zero. On the stock side, U.S. stocks are expensive. European stocks and emerging market stocks aren't. In fact, on the value side, they're downright cheap. So the opportunity to put some of my money into non-U.S. stocks, especially on the value side, is very appealing. The opportunity to buy emerging market stocks on the value side, very appealing, especially because emerging markets do well if U.S. inflation kicks up. And it sure looks like that is happening. It sure looks like our policy leaders in Washington are bound and determined to create some serious inflation in the coming 3 to 5 years, and are dismissing it as transitory. One of my favorite economists on Wall Street, Savita Subramanian from B of A, coined the expression last March, suggesting that we were headed for transitory hyperinflation. I love the term.
Hyperinflation.
She said it's gonna hit high single digits, maybe cross over into double. And then it'll settle back down. And the key question is, does it settle back down to 2, in which case things are kind of benign, or does it settle back down to 5, in which case the value of the dollar falls in half every 14 years. So there's diversification is very important. Most investors are inadequately diversified, and most investors chase growth, not value.
Right, and that seems to be the case with a lot of people, because they look at the stock market like going to a casino, and they want to hit big because it's, I think, just part of what's been enculturated. Oh, if you play the stock market, you could win big. But they don't listen to the second half, but you could also lose big too. So when we talk about this value investing and using fundamental factors for our decision making, what investment time horizons do we want to be considering for these when we talk about that intestinal fortitude factor?
Well, you want to be able to, you want to buy into a strategy where if it goes horribly wrong for a year, you'll be okay. You'll stay the course. If it goes moderately wrong for 2 years, you'll stay the course. Nobody's going to stay the course if it goes wrong for 5 years. Mm-hmm. So the notion of having some dose of patience is important. And that's also where diversification comes into play, because if you have income and growth and value all represented in your portfolio, if one of them drops 30 or 40%, your aggregate portfolio is down 20. Most of us can handle a 20% drop without blowing a gasket. Mm-hmm. And so the notion of diversification becomes important. And the other thing that's interesting is markets are driven by fear and greed. One of the fears that gets bandied about but not studied closely is FOMO, fear of missing out.
So
people will buy a frothy growth strategy because they're afraid of missing the next step up. Mm-hmm. My reaction to that is very simple. Do it only if you have a well thought through exit strategy. What will cause you to sell? Otherwise, you're going to keep buying right on up until you'll be picking up nickels in front of a steamroller until the steamroller squashes you flat. And so if you don't have an exit strategy, don't do it.
Excellent. I'm fascinated by our conversation. I was really impressed with the answers that you had given in our panel at Freedom Fest. And where can folks find the places where your strategies are embedded?
Okay. Our ideas, our business model is very unusual. We develop investment strategies. We license them through others, big investment management houses that embrace our ideas and make them available to their clients. So we've got about $180 billion under management using our ideas. We don't directly manage any of it. That way we don't have to have call centers. We don't have to have client reporting capabilities. We can be singularly focused on R&D. So Schwab has Schwab Fundamental Index strategies. Invesco has Invesco RAFI strategies. PIMCO has PIMCO RAE strategies. You can get, if you're investing multiple millions, you can get separately managed accounts through BlackRock, SSGA, Parametric. Parametric does it with loss harvesting and other tax management techniques, which are very cool. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of different ways to do it. But if you look for RAE or RAFI, RAFI, or Fundamental Index, that's going to be our strategy, any of those three.
Excellent. Well, if folks want to find out more about what you do and the research and the work that you have going on, how do they get a hold of you?
Thank you. Our website, researchaffiliates.com, or if you want to type a shorter name, RALLC.com, takes you straight to our website. Our website has lists of access to our research. We've had over 400 published papers of research in the last 20 years. We produce about 20 a year. It provides links to those who offer products that we've developed for them. And it also has two interactive tools, one called Asset Allocation Interactive. And if you just Google Asset Allocation Interactive, it'll take you straight to that website, which looks at forward-looking returns, not past returns, forward-looking expected returns for 130 different markets around the world. And it's updated every month. Smart Beta Interactive looks at about 25 different strategies and about 25 different factors in US, international, and emerging markets, looking at forward-looking return expectations. Is this strategy trading cheap, or is the strategy trading rich relative to its history? And based on that, what do we expect its return to be over the next 5 years? So these are powerful tools. They've gone viral. The Asset Allocation Interactive has had over 1 million unique hits since we launched it in 2017. Smart Beta Interactive has had about a fourth of that. Clearly a lot of folks are tapping into our work.
Absolutely they are, my nephew being one of them, because I was like, okay, I can't answer these questions. They're getting too technical for me. And I just pointed him there. So I was super impressed with your website. Well, thank you again for being a part of the show. And I'd love to continue this discussion at another time. And for those of you without a pencil, never fear, unlockyourwealthtoday.com is here, where you can visit Rob's show page, get the links to all of his great resources, and so much more. And for more great interviews, tools, and resources to help you overcome your personal and professional challenges to get out of debt, achieve financial freedom, and live the life of your dreams right now today, again, that website is unlockyourwealthtoday.com. I'm Heather Wagenhals, and I'm making success simple for you. Now go out and unlock your wealth today.
UnlockYourWealthToday.com is produced by Heather Wagenhals and the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation. Unlock Your Wealth Today and affiliate brands are copyrighted 2021 by Heather Wagenhals, all rights reserved. For more information about the Keys to Riches financial philosophy or this week's free strategy, please visit UnlockYourWealthToday.com.